In the cozy den of the large but modest house in Omaha, where he had lived since he started on his first billion, Warren Buffett watched the horrors of Hurricane Katrina unfold on television in early September 2005. He saw the furious winds and the avaricious waters breach the levees to cover three-quarters of the historic city of New Orleans. He saw helicopter video crews surveying tens of thousands of residents lost, marooned, or fleeing the devastation of the roiling waters. He saw terrified people isolated from their would-be rescuers, too distant and too few. Deeply affected, he stayed home the next day to watch the nonstop coverage of floating corpses, people stranded on housetops crying for help with outstretched arms, chaos and collapse inside convention and sports arenas, overflowing with human despair, human kindness, and human depravity. He saw the exodus of thousands fleeing along the roads to anywhere, mothers and fathers clutching their children's hands, sometimes the whole extended families, all of them looking for water, food, medicine, any kind of shelter. On the fourth day, he beheld in disbelief the paralysis of local, state, and federal authorities, unable to commence basic operations of rescue and sustenance, not just in New Orleans, but in towns and villages all along the Gulf Coast. How could this be happening in the world's wealthiest country, with all the tools of modern engineering and meteorology at its disposal? Where was the Louisiana National Guard? Deployed to Iraq? How could bureaucracies so contagiously prevent each other from performing the tasks for which they existed? Why were the rescuers mostly ad hoc volunteers propelled to action by care for their neighbors? Warren was shaken to his core, so much so that he postponed closings on two large corporate acquisitions. He hadn't had a clue about the ineptitude or recklessness or rottenness of the people in power, who couldn't seem to respond to a vast natural disaster after years of assurances that they were ready for any calamity. Even the poorest of countries buried their dead quickly. What must the world think of a supposedly advanced country that left bodies bobbing in swollen waters or rotting in the post-Katrina sunshine? Warren felt a wave of shame that bored through to his gut, his soul. He had to do something, personally, immediately, at least for the refugees on the roadsides. For now, the hardest hit place of all, the Ninth Ward, was inaccessible. He summoned two assistants, one to drive him nonstop down to New Orleans, the other to arrange for truckloads of food, water, blankets, portable toilets, basic medicine, sturdy tents, and sleeping bags, all to be accompanied by as many public health workers as they could muster. 26 hours later, he and his convoy arrived at a scene from Goya or Hieronymus Bosch. Some 2,000 people lined the roads, babies, children, parents, grandparents, stunned or crying or dozing fitfully, hungry and homeless and hopeless. Warren's relief workers quickly took charge. The physicians and medics erected temporary structures where they could mend the injured and treat the sick. Life-sustaining supplies were distributed on the spot. Canvas shelters were soon in place. In the midst of all the activity, Warren was supervising and helping in the distribution up and down the roadside and into the adjoining fields. Word began to spread to the astonished families who thought the world had abandoned them. A mega billionaire from Nebraska had arrived with critical resources and personnel. The refugees watched in wonder as the renowned septuagenarian in jeans and rolled up sleeves moved along the road, clearly in command. Coming upon a family of a dozen or so adults and children huddled around a crude campfire, Warren reassured them. He took their hands, hugged their trembling children, and looked into their eyes. The old-timers noticed that there were no reporters, no photographers, no television crews. A composed elderly grandmother cupped his hands in hers and cried out, "Only the super rich can save us."
That is great. Thank you.
Okay.
You should write this kind of thing more often. So is this a fantasy of yours that Warren Buffett and a few other mega billionaires will step forward and pay for the basic services?
Yeah, well, if you read the book, you'll see it's really very realistic detail. Once you accept the assumption of 17 real-life super-rich Americans with all their contacts and experience in their 70s, 80s, and 90s when they have a different perspective on life, moving their resources and know-how to the side of the people and taking on the power structure and building from the community on up and tapping into all the talent and of folks and in the communities, everything else could happen.
And some of the people you mention in your book, I mean, some of your characters are Warren Buffett, Barry Diller, Ted Turner, George
That's right.
Soros, Bill Cosby.
They're all real people in fictional roles. However, I lead from their background. I don't lobotomize them and create them anew. So I lead from their background, their skill, their contacts, what they've done in an enlightened way. And there's a lot of dialogue. And this book will be rediscovered. It was a bit ahead of its time because people are either used to nonfiction or novels, you see. And this is in between.
So why don't you call this a novel? I mean, it is.
Because
fiction.
It's not a novel because it doesn't have character development and a plot. It's technically called A Practical Utopia. That's a technical phrase. But utopia, to most people think, is, you know, pie in the sky. But in literary circles, you know, like the book Looking Backwards, mm-hmm. 100 years ago.
By Edward Bellamy?
Yeah. That is a utopian book. And Thomas More's book, Utopia, utopian book. But the difference is those books described an existing utopia far away in time or in place. Like with Bellamy, it was the year 2000, and he wrote it in 1886. This one shows how to get there, but there is not a utopia. It does show how to make a lot of basic overdue changes in every area of our society.
So I guess I'm trying to figure out how to read this book. I mean, you've spent your whole life going after corporate America, criticizing them, and here you are. It sounds like you're serious about this, saying, you know, if these super rich people, some of the richest people in the country, would just step forward, they could actually solve a lot of problems in America by giving away their money.
When you see the collision of what they built around the country with the Wall Street barons and Congress, you'd say this definitely can happen. I've learned never to stereotype 100%. You can stereotype 99% of the super rich as narcissistic and short-sighted. In their later years, just wanting to relax. But there's always that small percentage that's got fire in their belly, and they've got a lot of good values, and they've done things in their past that have been good, too. Don't get me wrong. These guys are hard-bitten businessmen. But when you reach an older age, you tend to have a bigger perspective regarding posterity. So you don't need many. You don't need. I could tell Buffett, you want to have a comprehensive rehaul of the tax system, Warren. Okay, well, split off $1 billion from the 32 you gave to the Gates Foundation, and I'll get it for you in 2 years.
Wait.
And you'll see exactly how it's done.
Wait, explain that. What should Warren Buffett do?
Reform?
Uh-huh.
It's got to go through one institution, doesn't it? It's called the Congress. So you're dealing with 535 people. That's what you're down to. And all the companies opposing you don't have a single vote. And you've got like 15 comprehensive ways to change the tax system. And almost all of them poll majority support in every district. So what's left is to organize the district like it's never been organized. And to each zero in on every representative and the two senators. And that's the way you do it. And how you zero in is written up in the book. You see how it was done in the most conservative district in southwest Oklahoma in the book.
Okay, how do you do that? Take me to that conservative district in Oklahoma.
What it needs is money and smarts. And there are a lot of smarts, but there's no money. But when you're willing to spend $15 billion, that's what this whole book turned the country around in, $15 billion. And, of course, it attracted a lot of media because, you know, whenever the super rich do stuff, they get free media. I mean, look at Perot, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they attracted a lot of free media, but they also had their own media. They bought up radio and TV stations, leveraged buyouts. That was Barry Diller's contribution.
And Ted Turner, he's one of your fictional characters,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, and Ted Turner was a big solar advocate. And was very flamboyant, and he knew how to get people's attention at the solar festivals. And then there was a clean elections party. But what I did was I took the most entrenched member of the House who had won 18 elections and was the chair of the House Rules Committee from the most conservative redneck district in America, which I put in Southwest Oklahoma, and I showed how to turn it around.
Okay, well,
you see, it's all about imagination, Steve, because if we don't imagine enough, our expectation levels of what we can get in this country and what our government should be like are so low that they actually abort any kind of public support. I mean, look at the polls. 18% only approve of Congress. Well, that's great. But why don't they ask themselves, why don't they look at Congress as a mirror? They don't approve of Congress because Congress sells out. They don't. This sells out because they don't do their job back home as voters and citizens.
Okay, so you're saying that with $15 billion and the clout of these super rich people who are, of course, famous around the country.
And smarts. They hire very smart people, thousands of organizers, thousands of lecturers. Yeah.
So what would change? You're saying the whole country could change. The political system would change. The economic system would change.
See, as long as you have public sentiment behind you, in other words, majority of the people agree we should have clean elections and crack down on corporate crime and so on. And as long as you have a sense of strategic location, you don't build up a lobby in Washington, you go back in every district. And as long as you have the money. I mean, at one time, they had 400 people in this book just recruiting, Steve. Recruiting.
Of course, billionaires, I mean, usually to become a billionaire, you have a massive ego, you have an agenda. This presupposes that these billionaires could actually agree on an agenda.
Excellent point. And that's what Warren Buffett provided. He's the one who chose them, took them to a hotel on a mountaintop in Maui, rented the entire hotel, and they had such respect for him that he raised their perspectives. And he basically said, look, I picked you out of many others for what you've done, but most important, for your temperament and your perspective. Almost every objection you can tell me in the next 30 minutes, I have foresaw, I planned for. Because that's what I had to do to make it realistic, you see?
Have you talked with Warren Buffett about your
novel? Oh, yeah. I had breakfast with him in Omaha, and he was quite pleased with the book. He invited me to his huge shareholders meeting, 40,000 people. To sell the book in I think it was May 2010. And we sold more books than any other books in that room because he was the hero, right? I mean, don't go to a Buffett shareholder meeting if you don't like Buffett.
And you clearly, I mean, you admire the guy, don't you?
Yeah, I do, because he says more of what's on his mind, which is on the mind of a lot of his peers, but they don't want to say it publicly. I also participated in an exchange at the New York Public Library with Ted Turner and Peter B. Lewis, who are two other billionaires in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And that's online, if you ever want to watch it. And it was filmed by C-SPAN, and it played about 2 months ago on C-SPAN.
So what did Ted Turner and Peter Lewis think of your book and your ideas?
Yeah, well, they mused all over the place. And I mean, you're right, they are real egos. And I was not their Warren Buffett. But there was a lot of candid talk and about, why they support things, why they don't, the lack of management skills by NGOs and how they want results. And they're tired of supporting things that don't have results. And so I said to him, we'll give you a whole menu of have results. Take a look at the book.
So do you think your book, your ideas, have inspired any of these billionaires to give away more of their money?
Well, I think that it really was one of the factors pushing along the Buffett-Gates Billionaires pledge, you know, to give over half of their money to good works.
Mm-hmm.
But as Buffett told me, we have to now figure out what good works are.
There's the rub.
Yeah, so it isn't just charity. The theme of the public library in New York was moving from charity to justice. In other words, moving from soup kitchens to a society where people don't go hungry to begin with, where there's full employment, etc. So justice is prevention of problems, and charity is attending to the problems and the anguish and the injuries once they occur. And there's got to be a better balance between the two. And they understood that.
So
justice is more systemic, and important as it is, charity is more palliative.
Hmm. So a final question. Suppose billionaires, whether they were in your book or not, you know, come forward, commit this $15 billion, you know, have smarts, as you say they need.
Yeah.
What would change? Paint me a vision of the country, that how it would change with this $15 billion given away in a smart way.
Well, first of all, full health care for all, which is more efficient, single payer. Living wage, that's, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars more a year, because the minimum wage is below what it was in 1968, adjusted for inflation, by a long shot, by the way. It'd be $10 an hour now if you just adjust for inflation. It's 7.25 federal now. It would be a much stronger enforcement budget to prevent and punish corporate crime, fraud, and abuse, like crime on ripping off Medicare, the Wall Street shenanigans, investor fraud, product defects, unsafe drugs, all of that, and many more, price fixing. There would be more community economics, more, as I mentioned, more credit, democratic credit unions, more community health clinics, more farmer-to-food markets, more local energy, wind power, et cetera. That would reduce the reliance and dependency of people on faraway corporations and skyscrapers making decisions for their lives. There would be a complete overhaul of the election process, no more gerrymandering, public funding of public campaigns through voluntary checkoffs, access to the mass media. There would be more control over what people own, the Commonwealth, public lands, public airways. People would get a return for building the semiconductor and pharmaceutical and aerospace and biotech and containerization industries through government taxpayer-funded R&D from the Pentagon and NASA and National Institutes of Health. They get nothing now. They get nothing for giving away their gold on federal lands to any company that discovers them. So there would be trust funds on that basis. And then there would be ways where people could band together so they could counteract the inevitable counterattack by the plutocracy, because they'd have their own stronger unions, they'd have stronger consumer groups broken down by commercial sector, banks, insurance companies, and so forth. They would have strong taxpayer groups to deal with corporate welfare, which is another change, mostly abolish the corporate welfare, the too big to fail. All that and much more. It goes into solar energy conversion. We have to accelerate our conversion to renewables, including passive solar architecture, wind power, geothermal, replace fossil fuels and nuclear. But above all, it would empower the citizenry so that they can take it on themselves and they don't need $15 billion every year.
Okay, well.
You see, I'm glad you're asking these questions, because this book is fertile material for your programs. It really does.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
When I signed this book, I put the following words in. To imagine is to envision. See, and that's the beauty of practical utopian writing. To imagine is to, if you can't imagine, you can't envision. And if you can't envision, you go through the day taking what they give you, for better or for worse.